Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 17th of July, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish. Brexit.
Well, she scraped through. The customs bill scraped through yesterday in Parliament. And, well, by three votes, in some cases, there were several amendments put forward by so-called Brexit MPs. Jacob Rees-Mogg thought it was sensible that the EU, if we're collecting taxes on behalf of the EU under this new customs arrangement, that the EU should be collecting the taxes on our behalf if it's in some kind of reciprocal arrangement. And they also wanted to stay out of the EU VAT regime completely, as they're describing it. In some cases, Theresa May only won some of these votes by three votes, which is a bit unfortunate, because there were three Labour MPs voted on her side. So if you take them out of the equation, it means that she actually didn't have a majority for some of these votes. So she's not in a terribly good position. So as a result, one MP, Good O'Beb, her now former defence minister, who just signed a deal with Lockheed Martin yesterday, so, you know, he was clearly doing his job, in inverted commas, he said, "I resign," and he resigned in the lobby just before the vote was taken so that he could vote against the government, because he didn't like what Theresa May is pushing forward as a so-called Brexit white paper in any way, shape or form. So she's in a pretty bad state. So perhaps it's unsurprising that the BBC and others reporting last night that she had, or at least the government, had put a motion into Parliament to see whether they couldn't persuade MPs to take their summer holiday a little bit early this year. So she's wanting them to go on holiday for the summer on Thursday this week rather than next week. So, she's clearly not feeling terribly happy at the moment. But as we discussed earlier, Brian, of course, if your aim is to create chaos, then she's doing a damn good job.
Total chaos, so the general public is confused as to what's going on. They're just fixing on Brexit next year, but of course they don't see it's Brexit without the exit. You want that confusion. I thought there was a slight irony there, Mike. You were saying that basically if we're collecting taxes for the EU, the EU should collect our taxes. But of course, if we remind ourselves that the EU as an organisation has still not produced a signed off audited set of accounts. I don't know how many years, it must be 20 something now. And we should remember that the whole of the Commission had to resign at one stage. Mr. Kinnock was in there at that point because of the fraud and corruption within the European Union, and that's continued. So will the EU be collecting taxes for UK? I very much doubt it.
No, probably not. Anyway, that's where we are. She's in trouble, and hopefully her government won't last too much longer. But in the meantime, yesterday, of course, in the afternoon, after we did our news programme yesterday, there was the press conference between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And I just thought we should go through a couple of the things that that they said in this press conference. Putin began, and he said, "I think we can call it a success and a very fruitful round of negotiations. We carefully analysed the current status, the present and future Russia-United States relationship, key issues of the global agenda. It's quite clear to everyone that bilateral relationship is going through a complicated stage, and yet those impediments, the current tension, the tense atmosphere, essentially have no solid reasons behind it. The Cold War is a thing of the past. The era of acute ideological confrontation of the two countries is a thing of the remote past." So he said, you know, today both Russia and the United States face a whole new set of challenges. There include dangerous maladjustment of mechanisms for maintaining international security and stability, regional crises, and creeping threats of terrorism and transnational crime. He said, "We can only cope with these challenges if we join the ranks and work together. Hopefully, we will reach this understanding with our American partners." He did talk about Syria, the crushing terrorists in the southwest of Syria. The south of Syria should be brought into the full compliance with the Treaty of 1974 about the separation of forces. about the separation of forces of Israel and Syria. This will bring peace to the Golan Heights and bring a more peaceful relationship between Syria and Israel, and also provide security for the state of Israel. But this is really the key point. Clearly, there are some challenges left, and we're not able to clear all the backlog, but I think we made the first important step in that direction. Trump absolutely echoing some of this, saying, I'm sure we'll meet again in the future often, and hopefully we'll solve every one of the problems that we discussed today. But I just thought we should spend a couple of minutes looking at the mainstream media hysteria over this. So here's Sky News's take on it. This is Dominic Waghorn. I'm not sure if that's a real name, but anyway, Dominic Waghorn, who's apparently the diplomatic editor. The world we have known for decades is coming apart, it seems, he says, disintegrating before our eyes. Never before have we seen an American president begin a summit with his Russian counterpart by blaming his own country for the nadir in relations between the two nations. And never have we seen a US president end one looking so under the spell of the same leader, a leader who has worked so hard to weaken the alliances and structures that have kept the West prosperous and secure for decades. If Donald Trump is not a Russian agent, he has certainly acted like one in the past week, working to promote the same Putin agenda. It's just incredible. It gets better, though. It does. It gets better. Because Politico magazine, Putin's attack on the US is our Pearl Harbor. Make no mistake, says this article, hacking the 2016 election was an act of war. It's time we responded accordingly. On December the 7th, 1941, the article says the Imperial Japanese Navy launched a surprise conventional attack against the US Pacific Fleet moored in Pearl Harbor. The attack happened without a declaration of war and without explicit warning, and Franklin D. Roosevelt responded the next day. On September the 11th, 2001, the Islamist terrorist group Al-Qaeda conducted four coordinated unconventional attacks against our nation. The attack happened without a declaration of war and without explicit warning, and President George W. Bush responded the next day. And it goes on to talk about Russia's cyber warfare capabilities. It says Coates named Russia as the most aggressive threat, saying the digital infrastructure that serves this country is literally under attack. Not in 2016, now it's happening all over again. And it keeps on going in this vein. For as long as history remembers Donald Trump, it will be a day that will live in infamy. Putin's attack on Pearl Harbor, an act of war by Putin on the United States. Are we sure about that? Because I think we'll find that the vast majority of the intervention in the United States, in the electoral process, is by Christopher Steele and Pablo Miller and the people that are, if not still within the auspices of MI6, certainly have very close connections. Richard Dearlove's included in that as well. So is it the Russians that have been attacking the United States in this way, or is it the United Kingdom? Well, I don't know. Let's go on. CNN Politics. Trump caved spectacularly to Putin. Let's see what might happen next. The president's summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki on Monday is already one of the most notorious moments in the tortured relations between Washington and Moscow. Trump's humiliation is taking its place alongside John Kennedy's bruising at the hands of Nikita Khrushchev and George W. Bush staring into Putin's eyes and getting a sense of his soul. But there are going to be profound consequences in Washington and beyond. Trump's performance on Monday followed his blitzkrieg through Europe, in which he split the transatlantic alliance and insulted allied leaders like Germany's Angela Merkel and Britain's Theresa May, effectively doing Putin's work for him. But Trump's behaviour raises questions about how top intelligence officials can remain in their posts after being so spectacularly thrown under the bus. Well, this was something that I saw the BBC focusing on, the fact that Trump had made comments criticising the FBI and other intelligence agencies. We don't need to worry about the fact that it was these same intelligence agencies that brought us into an illegal war in Iraq with Yellowcake and other nonsense, and the same intelligence agencies that in fact have put in two dodgy dossiers with regard to Russiagate. Utter hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy might, but I think we can look on the bright side and say that the Western media is having to come out of the shadows now. They are so desperate because their rules-based world order plans are falling apart. They're having to come out of the shadows. Each statement they make is more ridiculous than the last. And of course, we're seeing this particularly vicious rhetoric when there's any sign of movement towards peace. Mm. So Trump, if you analyse what he has said, we need to talk to Russia, we need to talk to Putin if we're to have any form of useful, productive dialogue. That's common sense, or seems so to me. This apparently is a threat to the Western world, and the media is having to come out of the shadows. We'll have a look at the BBC in a minute and see what they've been up to.
Well, in the meantime, Putin was commenting on the continuing Novichok issue with the United Kingdom. And he said that, he was speaking to Fox News, actually, he said that we recently learned that two more people suffered from the same nerve agent that is called Novichok. I've never even heard the last names of these persons. Who are they? What kind of bottle was it found in? What was the chemical formula? Or maybe there are other reasons for death. Maybe it's the internal reasons within the United Kingdom, but nobody wants to look at the issue. Now we just see the underground accusations. Why was it done this way? Why our relationship should be made worse by this pretense? We want to build relations with the UK as well as with the United States. We would like to have at least some sort of document, evidence about it, but nobody gives it to us. It's the same thing as the accusations of meddling in the election process in America. So he's pretty incensed about this whole situation, and understandably so, because, well, the British government continues to pursue this narrative without any evidence. As we mentioned on yesterday's programme, they've now called in the OPCW to try to shore up their pretty shaky ground that they're on. But of course, now the OPCW has been given this this ability to attribute blame as well. So I think that probably explains Putin's position here.
I think it does, Mike. I also found it interesting that the son of Dawn Sturgis, the lady who died in the incident, the son is asking for his mother's body so that they can carry out a private funeral. But the British state is now saying, no, we own the body. So the lady's body is owned by the British state at the moment. And why is that? Well, perhaps it's to hang on to the body, because this is going to be part of the evidence put through the OPCW. We shall see. But it's amazing how many times the state simply now says what it's doing. Mm. There's no discourse, there's no discussion. If Parliament says it, it's going to happen. The British state here, whatever that means, says it owns the body. Does the British state? I think there's some interesting questions. But it seems that Putin should be happy about this little deal, because the Indians have decided they want to go ahead with a very big deal for Russian S-400 missiles. But it's the headline that caught our attention. US law doesn't apply here. India's defence chief resists pressure over the deal with Russia. Well, what's this about? Well, this is the deal itself. It says, refusing to bow to the threat of potential sanctions, Sitharaman, the defence minister for India, said that the $5.7 billion US dollar deal to purchase five S-400 units has been finalised. Our defence relation with Russia has endured several decades, and we conveyed this about it to a US congressional delegation who visited India recently. And so this is reported by the Indians. And what are they talking about? Well, they're talking about this, the so-called Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, which mandates that the US administration is to punish entities engaging in significant transactions with Russia's defence sector companies. So any company in the world now is told, can be told that you're not doing what America wants you to do. Either you do what the Americans say, or we're going to punish you with some form of sanctions. Mm. Interestingly enough, the Indians here have said, well, this is not international law. This is simply an imposed American law, and we're not going to pay attention to it. Why are they buying those S-400s, Mike? I suspect because they are better than the American equipment, or at least cheaper.
This is what the Turkish said. They said, why would we buy anything else? There's nothing else that can compete with this. piece of equipment, why would we buy anything else?
Yeah. Well, if that's the situation with India, and of course India very, very capable at producing its own defence equipment, that's for another time. But let's have a look at what Britain's Royal Navy spokesman said. We do not routinely discuss the material state nor operational programmes of our vessels. Now, why do you think they might have said that, Mike? Well, the answer is this little headline. Elite £1 billion destroyer breaks down again after leaving Portsmouth. Freudian slip for a naval man, Plymouth. So we've got one of our famed Type 45 destroyers. These are the ones that can't operate in the warm water. Constant problems with their engines. This thing was supposedly the on-call ship, so an emergency of some description, a foreign warship, a Russian warship coming through the channel. This would be the ship that is called to sail, to go out to track, follow, defend the nation. But they just got clear of Plymouth when they broke down, dead in the water.
I wasn't aware that the water was that warm off the coast of Plymouth.
This is a bit of a worry, Mike. We're not sure how warm the water was, but in any case, the ship broke down. And ultimately, it was brought back by three tugs and appeared to have no main propulsion at all. But this is what the Ministry of Defence has said, that all six Type 45s have been affected with power loss. Ministry of Defence is planning to replace the current two specialist engines with three more powerful units in a, quote, £1 billion overhaul called the Power Improvement Project. So six ships are going to swallow another £1 billion worth of taxpayers' money in order to get them working operational. And the statement from the Navy was, we don't discuss this. Well, I think our answer to that is that the discussion needs to start, and it needs to start right now. And presumably we'll be seeing our local Plymouth MPs, Gary Streeter, and the other gentleman whose name escapes me, Johnny Mercer, starting to ask questions. £1 billion to patch up six ships that have never worked properly since they were brought into service. It is outrageous. Okay, well, let's come on to the BBC. The BBC, famed for only reporting news which is favourable to the BBC, the British government, and some other overseas states. And thank you very much to the person who drew my attention to this. It's a report from the Jerusalem Post. And the article itself is about a lot of people taking to the streets in protest against what's called the Nation State Bill. And the bill is expected to come to a final vote in the Knesset Monday. So that's already taken place. But why were people so agitated about this? Well, before we come on to some of the comments made, the Jewish Nation State Bill is apparently a draft basic law with constitutional force that declares the country as the nation state of the Jewish people. It would anchor in law the state's menorah emblem, Jerusalem as the capital, national holidays, and the right of all residents to preserve their heritage without consideration of religion and nationality. It all sounds good when it starts out. It would make Hebrew the official language of the state, with Arabic receiving a unique status, therefore demoting it from being an official language as it is today. So now we start to see some of the undertones coming in. The section of the bill that says the state may allow a community, including members of one religion or one nationality, to maintain a communal settlement. And that comment's drawn criticism from Mr. Rivlin, the Attorney General's office, and the Knesset legal advisor. So this is ramping up support for the new communities which are being pushed into Palestinian lands. But let's have a look at the comment on screen. Some of the protesters are saying, because the government is not willing to recognise this, because they have no solutions for any of us, not the housing crisis, not for the elderly and disabled, not for the high cost of living, not for the collapsing healthcare system, not to the crisis with the Jews of the diaspora. They are legislating unnecessary, terrifying, discriminatory laws like the nation-state law. The law incites, confuses, and divides citizens of the state of Israel from one another. So we are seeing a wide body of the of Jewish society coming here to protest. There's another quote, which I think we should have a look at. The message of Saturday's protest, according to the organisers, that we're all equal citizens, Arabs and Jews, women and men, Mizrahim, Ethiopians, those of us from the former USSR, and members of the LGBT community. The law of division and discrimination that this government is promoting, which they call the nation state bill, will leave a great many of us out of towns with admission committees, out of fair treatment in the courts, out of citizenship, out of democracy. To this, we will not agree. So some pretty powerful comment and thousands of people on the streets. It didn't take long for me to discover that the BBC simply doesn't want to cover this, Mike. I had a look at their website. I did a bit of basic searching on it for Israel and the nation state laws. Whatever I seemed to put in, I came up with nil return in the search. So if anybody else can find it and correct me on this, I'll be happy to publish it tomorrow. But as far as I could see, this was not a topic that the BBC wanted to talk about, even though, Mike, you've got such a widespread of the community there. You've also got LGBT involved, which is normally a trigger for the BBC to stand up for anybody's rights within that community group. This was part of the information in the Jerusalem Post, which I think really shows the breadth of opinion here. The participating organisations were standing together: the Association of Ethiopian Jews, the New Israel Fund, Peace Now, the Israel Religious Action Centre, the Coalition Against Racism in Israel, Masalwa Centre, Young Labour, Hadash, Meretz, Tal, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, Zazim, Community Action, the Negev Coexistence Forum for Civil Equality, Najek, Kulan Socialist Struggle, Competence for Peace, and Shatil. Now, I do not know the details of all those organisations, but I think it does show that something special was happening here, but the BBC didn't want to cover it. I wonder why that was. So if we just come in with this final bit here, basically, Meretz leader Tamar Sandberg opened her speech with a call for calm and peace in the south. This is a result of the latest attack on Hamas. Now is the time to prevent the next war, she said. But what we see is that the Israeli government is trying to hide the fact that it has no solutions with racist and insightful bills. And Rabbi Gilad Karif went on to say, do not play your political poker game for the elections at the expense of the image and values of Israeli society and at the expense of the, I think that's just the generous society here. And he also ended his speech with a prayer for peace in the south, a topic not forgotten by speakers at the protest, which came at the end of a day of fierce conflict with Hamas. So just remarkable, Mike, that as with Trump and Putin, if there's any movement towards people standing up to say, well, come on, let's settle down, let's get on with each other, let's not go down the path for war, the BBC is simply not interested in covering that. Mm. So pretty blatant stuff, really. Human rights.
Yes, human rights. Well, the government is all for human rights. It's published its latest Human Rights and Democracy Report today. Lord Ahmad is the main man behind that. So apparently this report is a barometer for the global human rights picture, with particular emphasis on the 30 human rights priority countries. Can't imagine that Russia's in there. Let's have a look. Bahrain, Bangladesh, Burundi, China, Colombia, Pakistan, Russia, Saudi Arabia. So there you go. Anyway, what did he have to say? Well, he said this. That's why today I would like to invite all of us collectively, partners working side by side, to join us in pledging support for the children born of sexual violence and conflict and innocent children. These are innocent children. That's not the correct quote. I do apologise for that. What he actually said was that 50 years ago, the UK played a vital role in drafting the seminal text that remains the cornerstone of human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. However, the ongoing repression of people's rights remind us that our work to defend them is pressing and as urgent as ever. So let's have a look and see what is in here. And we'll just say before we go any further that Russia has been mentioned 40 times in this document. Get a feeling for what the focus is here. Here's what they said. The foreign agents and undesirable organizations laws continue to constrict space for civil society. In 2017, four foreign donors were designated undesirable organizations. This is in Russia, of course. While the number of foreign agent NGOs dropped in 2017, this is partly because many NGOs have either stopped accepting foreign funding or have changed their focus. 47 have ceased operations entirely. There are now around 500 human rights organizations in Russia, compared with 800 in 2014. And then President Putin extended the foreign agents legislation to media outlets. Independent media continues to face threats, harassment and intimidation. This is hardly surprising under the circumstances. The fact of the matter is that many of these NGOs are being used by the West as effectively foreign agencies, foreign intelligence agencies, and also to subvert the nation, as it were, and subvert local opinion, local laws. So Putin is absolutely right to push forward with his foreign agent bills. And as this is said, although the number of NGOs labelled foreign agents has dropped in this past year, that's because quite a number have left the country and stopped operations.
And I think we need to add in there, Mike, that, of course, in the West, the use of powerful NGOs to drive the political agenda is the part of the move towards participatory democracy, where the individual is forced out and the view is put forward via the NGO or the charity. So I would totally agree. Putin should remove more of these organisations if he wants to protect Russia from unrest.
Yeah, it's just a shame that there isn't quite such an awareness of the activities of these organisations in Western countries as there is in countries that have overtly experienced colour revolutions or that type of activity. But anyway, I was amused by this little tweet sent out by UK Against Daesh. If you have a search for at UK Against Daesh on Twitter, you'll find this. Because the Foreign Office Minister, Alistair Burt, is going to be hosting a Twitter question and answer session on the 23rd of July. And they're asking for people to vote on the area of UK foreign policy that you're most excited about. And the three options they have included are, first of all, progress in Mosul, where, of course, the Western-backed Iraqi and so-called liberation of Mosul managed to kill so many civilians. So perhaps we might want to ask about that. Stabilizing Iraq and Syria. We might want to ask about that. Indeed, white helmets comes to mind. And the UK's aim to defeat Daesh. Well, perhaps we've got some questions to ask there about the UK's funding for Daesh, people that are associated with Daesh or ISIS. That's a nice little Q&A coming up in a couple of days' time, and maybe people would want to get involved in that.
Get on, be active, polite, reasonable, and put some pressure where it should be applied. Mm. Well, let's have a little look at the situation with the protests around Tommy Robinson. And first of all, I'd like to thank our viewers and listeners who listened to the report that we made on Friday, because we received a lot of very positive comments after that news. And so we're going to follow through on this. Report here from the Evening Standard about the latest demonstration on the weekend just gone. Tommy Robinson protest, 12 arrests amid clashes as thousands of activists descend on Whitehall. Now, the numbers seem to be considerably smaller than previously. And I think there's talk of about 2,000, 3,000, possibly 4,000. But unless those reports are wildly inaccurate, it does not seem there were large amounts of people. But what is fascinating, if you go through UK's press and media, what you don't find is any mention of the organisers, the Middle East Forum, which we flagged up to our viewers and listeners on Friday. So this was the screenshot from the Middle East Forum's website, where they had a whole article boasting about how they were supporting Tommy Robinson by providing money for his legal defence, but also getting people on the streets. And that was the previous demonstration and the one that's just occurred this weekend. So just fascinating that you have an organisation that declares itself as facilitating everything that's happening around Tommy Robinson, the money and the organisation, and yet the mainstream media simply don't report this at all. Why would this be? Well, just to remind people what sort of organisation the Middle East Forum is, this was part of their quote where they were talking about the... Sorry, I'll just come back one if I may. They were talking about Israel Victory Initiative. The Middle East Forum seeks a full-time Israel director for its Israel Victory Project, which holds that a Palestinian defeat is a precondition to resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict. This means ditching the peace process in favour of Israel, quote, imposing its will on its enemies. So here we go again, Mike. We've got somebody saying, let's get rid of any form of peace process. What does imposing your will mean in a volatile situation like this in the Middle East?
Well, it's military. Killing people.
It means killing people.
But this is as Zionist as it gets then, really?
I would say so. But no, excuse me, nobody wants to talk about it. I did a search of the BBC website, and although I can come up with a lot of material on Tommy Robinson, there's no mention at all about the Middle East Forum. So a deafening BBC silence on an ultra-extreme pro-Zionist, pro-Israel organisation, which is backing Tommy Robinson, and ultimately violent London protests. So why is this occurring? We don't know the answer to this yet, but we're going to stay digging in the subject area. Let's remind ourselves of what was happening a few years ago, because this independent report we did pick up on, and it was the article was talking about a new row between the London School of Economics and the BBC as ex-EDL leader Tommy Robinson turns up to a film lecture. Now, what was going on here was the London School of Economics was having a talk by a lady called Karima Benoun, an Algerian-American professor in international law. And the BBC basically said, can we come and do some filming? And ultimately, the BBC turned up with Tommy Robinson. I'll take you through in a little bit more detail. But this was being reported on the 27th of October 2013. So what was the BBC up to? Why was Tommy Robinson involved with the BBC? Let's remind ourselves of what we couldn't find out at the time. So here was the lady giving the lecture. The BBC is in the middle of this. And this was the man who was the key BBC person, Aqil Ahmed, BBC head of religion and ethics. And the BBC and Mr. Ahmed was working with a media organisation called Coolus Media. And where did it go from here? Well, the BBC said they also wanted to come and see what this man had to say, Mr. Nawaz. Now, he was chair of the Quilliam and Global Islamist Party. He's ex-London School of Economics student political theory, but he was also working with the Quilliam Foundation, which was supposedly a counter-extremism think tank. So surprisingly, in the middle of this, we find that the BBC was working with Tommy Robinson, and the BBC, as I've said, after asking the London School of Economics if they could come and film the people speaking, turned up with Mr. Robinson and essentially gatecrashed and ambushed the London School of Economics, who were considerably put out because they said, this is the last thing we need because we're trying to have a discussion here about peaceful matters. So big questions to be asked about this Coolus Media. Who are they? Well, we asked the question at the time. We did the sensible thing, which is to go and have a look at their webpage. This is it, setting the scene on centre stage. This is a website that tells you some things, but it doesn't give you any detail. It doesn't give you names. It doesn't give you track record of the directors or the expertise being used. It's just a funny little company with a London telephone number. That was the telephone number at that particular time. Now, we went a step further and we sent an email into the BBC to ask some questions. And we said, "Dear Press Office, the Independent has reported that Tommy Robinson, ex-EDL, attended recent LSE event. LSE claims that Robinson attended on the back of a BBC documentary on Mr. Nawaz, and Robinson is partnering with Coolis Media. Or, sorry, the BBC is in partnership with Coolis Media. My question is, who is Coolis Media? Their website gives no company details, directors or other names. And two, what is the precise contractual relationship between the BBC and Coolis, which does not appear to exist as a company, not at least by their website at that point?" Well, back came the BBC's reply. "Dear Brian, Coolis is in the early stages of developing a programme for the BBC, for which it has been filming with Tommy Robinson and think tank Quillam Best." So the BBC simply doesn't answer the questions, which leads us to be saying, what was going on here? Why did we have the BBC working with Tommy Robinson? We don't know. But what's interesting is that if we go and have a look at this company today, the website is still there. It's been updated. It's been beefed up. Here they're boasting of the organisations that they're working with, of which the top is the BBC. Encourage people to go and have a look at this site themselves, because this little video clip apparently advertises the professionalism of this media company. I found it incredibly childish and pathetic, but that might just be my personal opinion. But we do get some interesting glimpses as to what this organisation is up to, because here is an inset where they're boasting of having provided an interview to The Sun, which is all around the Lee Rigby affair. So are these media people, or are they some form of investigators? What are they, and how do they exist in quite a prestigious London address? We can just bring this on screen for you. So they are on the third floor of 207 Regent Street, London. But what's surprising is that if we do our company checks, we actually find that this company has been dissolved. That's Coolis Media Limited. So are they still trading at the moment? By their website they are, but what is the vehicle? We don't know. And just to show that we did our homework on, here's the company's house warning letter saying to Coolis Media that you've got 3 months, and if we don't get the proper replies from you, you're going to be struck off. And later on the 22nd of March 2016, Coolis Media Limited was dissolved. So a lot of questions to be asked about the BBC's relationship with that company, but also, of course, their relationship with Tommy Robinson. And we can come back to the question, why is it that the BBC doesn't want to mention the Middle East Forum, which is backing Tommy Robinson and helping to arrange those protests? Mm. If any of our audience or listeners can help us with information on this, please send it through to us. We're simply asking the questions at the moment, but we're going to say we don't get a good feeling as to what the BBC is up to out of sight of the general public.
Okay. The Law Society is holding an event in a few days' time, Public Policy, Technology and Law Commission evidence session, all about algorithms in the justice system. So you can register for free and go and log to that if you want. It's in Chancery Lane in London. There's no charge. So the Law Society of England and Wales has a strong interest in the impact of technology and data use on human rights. To help us understand this very broad issue, we will be examining one specific aspect, the use of algorithms in the justice system. So they wanted to take evidence from a range of experts from tech, government, commercial and human rights areas on whether algorithms and their use within the justice system should be regulated, and if so, how. So they will have a presentation from Christina Blacklaws, who's president of the Law Society, and then they're taking evidence from some commissioners of the Law Society and also from Sylvia Delacroix from the Law and Ethics Department at Birmingham Law School. Now, this is quite an interesting thing. These are some of the questions that are being considered. What algorithms that you know of are currently in use in the justice system in England and Wales? Are there any algorithms that you know of that are currently being developed for use in the justice system in England and Wales? What are some of the benefits that can be derived from the use of algorithms in the justice system? What are some of the dangers? How does bias in decision-making cut across existing legislation? Are there any algorithms currently in development for use in the justice system? And so it goes on. And they're calling for written evidence as well. But anyway, they're holding these, they're going to hold three public sessions where their commissions are going to take oral evidence from experts on this topic of algorithm use within the justice system. Brian, I do wonder where this is going to end up. Are we going to have 12 good robots and true on juries in the not too distant future, making algorithmic decisions about people's guilt or innocence, because really human beings are just not reliable enough when it comes to making decisions in juries?
I think that's exactly where these people would like to take it, Mike. Many people say that this sort of thing is ridiculous, incompetence. I don't think it's that at all. I think this is a very, very dangerous, calculated policy, which is pushing the human side of decisions to one side. And my goodness, we need that jury in place to make the right decisions. So we've got an algorithm, a mathematical model being used to decide what, whether somebody is guilty or innocent. This is immensely dangerous stuff. But the policy keeps coming through. So my question is, who were the people who have produced this policy? Can we know them by name? And where did they make these decisions? Were these decisions made in public view, or are they more policy decisions that have been made behind closed doors? And of course, one of the things we now know is that it is only within the Cabinet Office that the core decisions are being made in UK. And within the Cabinet Office, we have the Pearl Office, which is the conduit between the secret society of the Cabinet Office and the commercial interests, the banking interests, the globalists, who are the key people driving in this sort of policy. So if people are wondering what they should be doing with this subject, I would say get on to your MP and ask a very simple question. Where did this policy come from?
Well, and go to this event, Wednesday, the 25th of July from 4 to 6 p.m. It's free to go to it. So somebody, if you could possibly get along to it and perhaps report back to us, that would be fantastic.
It would. Well, we just, with a smile on my face, although it's a black subject, as it were, I wonder what the algorithm would make of this little decision. So former Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, is allowed to preach again just weeks before child sex inquiry looks into allegations that he covered up abuse. This is around Bishop Ball, Peter Ball, excuse me, and there are allegations that George Carey colluded with Bishop Peter Ball. But there's an inquiry about to take place. They're not reinstating this man as a bishop, but they are allowing him to preach. It's just incredible timing, Mike.
And that's Kerry's decision, was it?
Pardon?
That was George Kerry's decision?
No, he's going to be allowed to preach, Mr. Kerry
right.
himself. Was this a human decision, or maybe it was an early trial of the artificial intelligence
yes.
and algorithms? We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. As I say, if anybody has got any information at all on what's been going on with the BBC, has the BBC been reporting the Middle East Foundation at all? If you could point us to the information, we'd be extremely grateful. That's it for today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
All right.